Dr. Simon Morocco conducted at the Jewish Community Center on the afternoon of February 19, 1986. The interviewer is Sidney Bolkowski. Okay, could you tell me your name, please, and where you're from?
I'm Simon W. Morocco, M-A-R-O-K-O. You prefer with the spelling, I presume. I'm an MD. You want my address?
No, so you live in?
I live in the city of Sylvan Lake, S-Y-L-V-A-N, which is next between Pontiac and Kigo Harbor.
Where were you born?
I was born in Tarnów, Poland, in 1923 on June 27th.
Did you grow up in Tarnów?
I stayed in Tarnów for about 10 months, and then as part of my father's career as a cantor and later on chief cantor, we moved to Pressburg, Bratislava in Czechoslovakia, kitty corner from Vienna. I have some early childhood memories from then in the Judengasse, the Jewish street there. And I stayed there until my third birthday, I believe on my third birthday or thereabouts, we arrived in Holland, in Amsterdam. And I've stayed in Amsterdam or in Holland from then, which was 1926 until 1946, when I left with Aliyah Beit to Palestine.
So you would consider yourself Dutch?
My education and upbringing and my accent is Dutch.
How many members were in your family?
I had one older sister, one older brother, and in Amsterdam in 26, a younger sister was born. We were a total of four children.
And your parents, was there an extended family also?
We were in Holland, the only branch of our family. All of our relatives remained in Poland.
How many members of your family remained in Poland?
My mother was one of nine. My father had one sister who also was living with us, which I, by the way, just now remember. My father's sister stayed with us until about 1929 or 30 when she got married. And then another sister of my father came to live with us, and she stayed there until maybe 5 or 6 or 7 years.
In Amsterdam,
she went back to Poland to marry someone there.
So the extended family, with aunts and uncles and cousins, how large would you estimate that was?
I know about my mother, who had eight siblings. And my father had, in Poland, left a few, maybe two or so. But I believe all of them were married and all had children.
Do you know how many of that family survived?
Of all those people, this first aunt that I mentioned survived. My father's sister and also a brother of my mother is alive and lives in Oak Park.
And the rest?
The rest all were in World War II.
What do you remember about life in Amsterdam as a child?
I have my memories of home life. We were Orthodox. My father was the chief cantor. He had a life contract. He was deeply religious. He believed in his religion and he lived it as much as anyone can expect of him. And so I went through all the customs of a religious family, starting with Modiani, prayer in the morning, washing the tips of your fingers, and all the way throughout the prayers, going every day to synagogue in the morning before going to school, for example, and then in the evening after school going to the Mincha and Maariv service.
What was the name of the shul?
In Dutch it was called the Grote Synagoge, which means the Great Synagogue. This was the synagogue that probably was older than the Portuguese synagogue. And it was the first synagogue of the Ashkenazi congregation. In Amsterdam, there was only one congregation in countries to the United States. I don't know how many members they had. My guess would be perhaps 20 or 40,000 out of a total of about 80,000 Jews in Amsterdam. So, there were many different synagogues next to the Great Synagogue, which is across from the Portuguese synagogue. Next to it was the mikveh, and if you went a little bit further, you got the New Synagogue, which was built later and therefore had the name of New Synagogue. And there were later on, over the centuries, when the Jews moved in different parts of the city, there were synagogues in east and in south, and there were many small synagogues. I would say there were perhaps a dozen or so synagogues, all belonging to the same congregation, each one with their own rabbi, with their own cantor. Sometimes was a second cantor, even for the weekly prayers.
I mean, they were all Orthodox?
They were all Orthodox, yes.
Did you have any interaction with the Sephardim?
I had interaction with the Sephardim in school. I have a memory of maybe the fifth or sixth grade, where I went to a school which was Orthodox. It was not a public school, and the name of the school was Palache, P-A-L-A-C-H-E, which was supposed to be pronounced Palatje, but it was named after a Sephardi rabbi. So it was here a school where a huge majority of the children were Ashkenazi, was named after a Sephardi rabbi. In our class, we had quite a minority of children who had Portuguese names, such as Rodriguez Pereira, Teixeira de Matos, Vastias, and so on. There was one girl in our class, she was the best of all the students. All the boys were in love, including myself, but we knew, which was very important, that any intermarriage in the future was completely out of the question. There was no intermarriage between the Sephardi, who considered themselves superior, and the Ashkenazi, who were considered inferior by them. As a result of that, there was a lot of intermarriage among the Portuguese Jews in Amsterdam. The result of that was that there were sometimes, as can be expected in any inbreeding, either people who were geniuses or mentally retarded or otherwise. They had the nickname of the Mexicano Portuguese. Therefore, because among them there were a certain number which were either mentally ill or retarded, whatever.
The parochial school you went to, you spoke what language in this?
Dutch was the official language.
And at home you spoke Dutch?
At home we spoke, my early childhood I couldn't say for sure, but later on we talked Dutch. Our parents wanted us to talk Dutch because they wanted to become Dutch citizens, which they never reached because World War II intervened. They spoke some Yiddish. There were the years before Hitler, I assume, that on Shabbos, my father insisted that we talk German, because that was then the high-class international language in Europe, Deutsch sprechen. I remember this, that he would say, if we were, if we deviated and started to talk in Dutch, he said Deutsch sprechen on Shabbos. It was like perhaps the status of the French language still now in, let's say, international diplomacy and so on. But after the start of Hitler and the Nazi Party in Germany, I think he changed his mind about that. My fathers, when they wanted to, my parents, when they wanted to communicate about something and us not to understand, they spoke Polish, which we did not understand, we children.
And they were originally born in Poland?
They were born in Poland, yes.
So were they Polish citizens?
My father and my parents came as Polish citizens.
And you were also Polish citizen?
I was a Polish citizen by birth, and I stayed a Polish citizen until my father, probably in the process of wanting to become a Dutch citizen, he surrendered his Polish passport and so on. So after the war, I found myself as stateless, without nationality, for some time.
What are your fondest memories of your household?
the family being together around the table on Shabbos or on Seder. There was a warmth there, a feeling of security, of peace. We knew what we could expect. It was all traditional, and each one knew what their role was. My father was the head of the household. It was old-fashioned Orthodox way. My mother, the ancient Chayla. And then the rest of the family, and sometimes we had guests, especially after 1933, we had people who came as refugees from either Poland or Germany. Sometimes people who had come from Poland to Germany and they came in Holland either on their way to some other country or not. One of them that I do remember was not a refugee, but it was one of my earlier times, was someone who had come from Palestine. His name was Amira. He was a dentist and he came from Odessa. He gave some free dental advice. He told me that I had a tremendous underbite like this, and he told me how to correct it. After the services, there were some one or more people left who didn't have any place to go for a meal, so my father was either the last one or one of the last ones to leave the synagogue. He took one, sometimes perhaps more, but usually one with him, our table.
Was there ever any trouble with anti-Semitism that you recall?
I lived in a relatively protected environment, going to Jewish elementary school, Jewish high school, and during World War II I went 1 year to University of Amsterdam pre-medical studies. I didn't know what anti-Semitism meant.
Did you have non-Jewish friends?
I did not have any non-Jewish friends. I played with my Jewish schoolmates who lived in the same street next to us. I do remember one occasion, which I don't think I have any proof that it was based upon anti-Semitism, but I was alone there and some Gentile strange boys came along, and I don't know what the reason is, but they completely caught me off guard and hit me in the solar plexus. I doubled up, as happens under those occasions, and I've never forgotten the experience, but they never connected it with the fact that they were not Jewish. In fact, I doubt whether it was done because of, they were, maybe I myself was perhaps 9 or 10, they were about that same age. It could have been, but I don't recall anything like that.
Was there ever any discussion of in your household about anti-Jewish acts or attitudes in Holland?
Not in Holland, but my father told me about his own experience while still living in Poland.
What did he tell you?
I remember that he said that when you walked in the streets in Poland, on the sidewalk, and a Gentile would pass, and if you did not step off the sidewalk, he would spit in your face, for example, if not worse. And on another occasion, he was on a train ride from somewhere, maybe Pabianice to Warsaw. The Gentiles did not let him inside. He had a little valise with him. He put it on the steps to get on the train with his back to the train itself, the valise being between his heels of his shoes and the train, and with both hands holding onto the handrails, he had to travel all that distance to until the train stopped. And they were laughing inside. This was reported as a sign of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And my father entered Holland from Czechoslovakia even, which was not as bad, I presume, as far as anti-Semitism is concerned, as Poland. He said that he could smell and sense the freedom there. equality, because Holland has a history, a tradition of equality, because they themselves had an 80-year-long war until 1648 against Spain, where there was religious persecution against the Protestants, and especially the Royal House of Orange had very strong positive ties with Jews who financed their revolt against the Spanish occupation in the 17th century.
So he was happy then.
He was very happy to come.
What about the National Socialist Bund?
The NSB.
Do you remember anything about them in the 30s?
I don't remember myself anything about that offhand. They came into play after a German invasion and occupation. Before that, they were a minority, and I myself don't have any recollections of any context. I didn't know what anti-Semitism meant, except for the people who came from Germany, from Poland, from Eastern Europe. I knew there was anti-Semitism, but not for us, for everybody but us.
What else stands out about the sort of daily life in Holland as a youngster there?
I can remember the typical Jewish customs in preparation for Pesach in front of the both the Great Synagogue and the New Synagogue, the Ashkenazi side of that square where now there is the statue of the dock worker. There was a whole row of huge containers with water with a fire under them for the kashering of the utensils for Pesach. Going to shul was a high percentage of my time. Every day before I went, let's say when I was a student in high school, I was sometimes starting pretty late after midnight. I had to get up in the morning, and I had to make up for lost time sometimes during my school hours, where I developed a technique of pretending that I was reading a book and was covering my eyes with a hand on top of my eyebrows. And maybe the teachers knew, but whenever they asked the question, my ears were not sleeping. If they called on me, I knew precisely where it was.
But you would not consider yourself and your family an assimilated family?
We were definitely not assimilated.
Were most Dutch Jews assimilated, you think?
I didn't know, but I have found out later on, or it was reported to me, or I read somewhere, that in Amsterdam, about 40% of the Jews were mixed married. And this was made possible, among other things, by the extreme equalitarian and liberal philosophy of a lot of the Dutch Gentile population.
At what point do you remember German and Polish emigres coming and telling stories of anti-Semitic acts in Europe?
I must have been, let's say, 1934. I was then 11, after age 11 or so. I may have heard more about this. But these things didn't have any personal meaning for me. It was all for them. It did not pertain to my life, because I didn't suffer myself from anyone in an anti-Semitic way.
Do you remember when the war began?
Yes, I remember the sounds of the bombs exploding at the airport of Amsterdam. I remember 4 days from our balcony, which was across from the zoo in Amsterdam, where we lived. I remember next to us there was the main garage of a taxi company. And I realized that there were acquaintances, perhaps even close acquaintances or friends of us, who were hiring taxi cabs to go to the port of IJmuiden, which was the closest point on the coast of the North Sea, and we were trying to get from there to England, and I understand some succeeded. I know for sure that there was an organized transport by bus for children, because one of my schoolmates that way survived the war. He was taken by bus to England, and he served in the Allied forces, and he came back after a war. His name was Gerson, which means Gerson Müller, but when he came back, his name was something like Mac. I mean, completely anglicized.
Hmm. So you were 17 then?
When the war broke out in 1940, I was almost 17.
Oh, 17. So what were you thinking, feeling about all this? Were you frightened?
I definitely remember what I felt. Outside of some of the events that happened during those 4 days where we had the blackout as far as not letting any light shine to the outside for fear of being bombarded. I remember the last of the 4 days when I looked outside and I saw the street lights were on. I cried because I knew what it symbolized. It meant defeat. There is also another memory I have about that time. It's funny, looking out of the little window which we had in our john, our toilet. We could see, or I could see, a nest of doves. After those 4 days, the doves were gone and never returned. That was also, to me, it had a symbolic meaning. I was in those days, on the one hand, quite orthodox religious, on the other hand, I would perhaps therefore be more inclined to see meaning in events, such as the symbolic meaning of the doves, the symbol of peace, disappearing.
What was the talk in your household about the war? Was there any discussion?
Of course. I don't recall it that easily. I can tell you something that may have something to do with it, also would reflect upon me. We had put strips on our outside windows as protection in case a bomb would come close and the glass might shatter. It would hold the glass together. I had placed on the upper part of the window in my room, on the front of the house, I had put those black strips in the shape of a Magin David. I do remember, and must have been after the Germans invaded, then my father came in my room and saw it. He was in horror and he told me right away to take it off for fear that the Germans might respond to it in a negative way.
Is there any talk about leaving?
Are you talking about leaving after the occupation or before?
Well, in those 4 days.
In those 4 days, no. But way later, when the deportations already had started, probably 1942, I remember my mother telling my older brother and me, why don't you leave and go somewhere in hiding? And I remember that I felt flabbergasted. I understood what she meant, but I felt so hopeless. I had no idea what to do about it. I've never done it before, so to speak. I had no idea how to go about it, and it took a lot more before I finally did it. They had to catch me twice before I finally considered it.
The Germans.
Right.
After the surrender, what was the sequence of events that you remember?
Okay. I graduated from the Jewish high school, and I perhaps should mention this because it's interesting and I'll come back to the events. I took the final exam after the Germans already had invaded, and the final exam was the equivalent for all high schools in Holland, and this Jewish school in particular was interested in having very good results. And there was a man from the government who came there to examine us in addition to our own teachers who would examine us. And that man asked me for the list of German literature that I had read or studied. I, for the first time in my life, I had a blackout. I could not remember one title. And now I understand, of course, this was my subconscious way of protesting anything German to express my lack of desire or satisfaction with anything German. okay, I did finish my grade for German was a lot less than what it might have been otherwise. I was accepted as a pre-medical student to the University of Amsterdam, and I finished the first year, which was then, let's say, towards the end or summer of 1942. I passed an examination, which is an extremely rigid, difficult examination, and around that time, and I would have to consult my notes to know precisely what happened first, the numerous clauses was started by the Germans. The Jews had to register the David Star and so on, and so I could not continue for the second year. The Jewish Council already had existed by that time, and they utilized the faculty of the College of Medicine of the University of Amsterdam, who were Jews, who had been fired, to start what really was intended to be a course in preclinical medicine. The name that it was given was massage and therapeutic gymnastics. We had both courses in massage and gymnastics, but we also had the various preclinical studies about the various preclinical basic sciences.
So this is a ruse of some sort?
It was definitely a ruse. And we were prepared in case that any of the Germans might question it, we could say yes, but we have massage and gymnastics. The other things were done in secret, were done in private homes.
Did you still attend services regularly?
I attended services until 1943, when I myself went in hiding. Until, let's say, less than a week before.
At the Great Synagogue?
Right, people always the Great Synagogue.
People continued to go even during the occupation.
There is an interesting thing that I remember, if you don't mind.
Please.
Going back. Before the World War II, and it could have happened even the after a German occupation. My father had a vacation in the summer, and sometimes, I remember at least one time, that he went to listen to the services in the other synagogues. And one time he went to the Portuguese synagogue. Now, in the Portuguese synagogue, there is a section in the center which is for Sephardi Portuguese Jews. Outside, in the periphery, Ashkenazi Jews or Gentiles are permitted. When my father came there, he and I, tailing with him, I was permitted to enter the central part as a sign of honor, of respect.
Because they know
was
your
shown.
Father.
Yes.
They knew your father.
Yeah, right.
Did he sing there?
No, not singing. He would sing in the other synagogues rarely, on special occasions. I think maybe once a year or so.
But always in yours, of course.
Pardon, always?
But always in yours, in the Great Synagogue.
No, he would once a year, he might go to some of the other synagogues. I don't know what was the idea behind it, the rotation or showing a flag almost or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I remember that that happened, but very seldom. When I was a visit by the royalty, he was the one who was singing in front of them. There are pictures of that probably still available. He has sang for the mother of Queen Wilhelmina, the presence of Queen Wilhelmina, when Princess Juliana, who is now the mother of the existing queen, was there when she was still a teenager. He was singing there. There was even a rumor that I heard that this Princess Juliana, being a teenager, fell in love with my father. I don't know whether it's true or not.
You had a very strong, beautiful voice then?
I would consider him as one of the top 5 or 10 or whatever in the world. As far as his quality as a tenor, he may not have been able to reach the high C as easily as Rosenblatt or some of the other world famous ones. But as far as rendering the intent, the content of the prayers, I think, and maybe I'm biased, he had no peer.
Let me just step back for a second. Your parents created this atmosphere in the house, obviously, of warmth and security. What do you remember about them? Did you have discussions with them as you were getting older that you remember before the occupation as well as during it? What are their outstanding characteristics of them?
My mother, I remember being in the kitchen. We had, before the war, maids. In fact, coming from Germany at times, because this was quite common in Holland. My father, I remember at home studying whether Gemara or Mishnah or whatever. And he, at times, he taught us. I also had private lessons in addition to the Jewish curriculum as part of the Jewish high school. I also had private lessons by a rabbi, which was consisted of Mishnah and Gemara. I must admit, whether it was his quality as a rabbi or whether I was to be blamed, I always felt a hypnotic effect of it. I had a hard time keeping my eyes open. I remember that definitely.
At what point was this life, religious life in particular, disrupted by the war? I mean, really disrupted so that you couldn't, the family couldn't function as it had before. And when did Shabbos dinners take on a different tone, for example?
They never had anything different until my family was deported.
So through 1943.
Right. I can imagine, because I don't have any direct recollection, but I can easily, safely assume that the spirit towards the end, even on Shabbos, was not as happy as it used to be, because the thousands, tens of thousands of people that were acquaintances and friends of my father, they were deported way before my parents were deported.
In 1940 now, the numerous clauses was passed.
Probably in 1941. The Germans did it the right way from their viewpoint. Move in very slowly so they won't have any excuse for reacting. It is like a subliminal approach almost. Any move that they made was so small that no person in their right mind would think of taking this as a reason, this own step in itself as a reason to start anything negative, aggressive, or whatever against the Germans. It was probably planned like that. That's my guess.
Do you remember the events of February 1941?
February 1941. I would have to go back to my notes, if I may.
When the NSB marched through the Jewish section of Amsterdam.
I myself have no direct witness recollection of this, but I do remember that there was a Dutch saying, "Kood is gedood door een Jood," which is a rhyme. It means that Kood, who was a member of the NSB, was killed by a Jew. So I knew that there had been some action and some Jews had responded to that. But this was all done in, it was not in our street, it was done in the Jewish neighborhood. We lived, let's say, a little bit outside of the center of the Jewish neighborhood.
Do you remember the general strike?
I was at that time a student at the University of Amsterdam, and I was in one of the laboratories. It could have been something like organic chemistry, some afternoon, and I heard shots of a machine gun like nature. I had no idea where it was. Later on, I found out that there had been some action against Dutch and that there was a strike.
Did it have any effect on you or your family, the strike?
I do not think so. We were continuing to live our life, and yes, I don't know precisely, was in 1942 or so, but my older sister was married, and one of her brother-in-law was taken by the Germans, and I think at the last moment he succeeded in not having to go, but others went, and their ashes came back from Mauthausen. The parents were asked to pay money for the ashes when no one had any 100% knowledge that it was really their ashes or just any ashes at all.
You had heard of Mauthausen by 1942?
Mauthausen, yes.
What had you heard about that?
That people were killed there. In other words, we knew that something had happened. It was, in other words, it was something that was slowly but surely approaching, and we didn't like it.
Do you remember the anything about the Jewish Council, the Hutzeran?
I have lots of memories of the Jewish Council. I wonder about direct memories. Can you start it? When I myself already had been brought by the Germans to the prison, which was the converted Dutch theater building. There were people there who had a band. They were members of the Jewish Council. Their task was to see to it that we would get our meals and in any other way could be of help to us. I talked to one of them and asked, is there any way of escaping here? I don't believe that he even gave me a direct answer. So I asked him, is there a John anywhere? He said, yes. I said, please show me. So he brought me there. If you want me to continue, I can tell you about my first escape from there.
Let's go ahead.
I had been brought there with other personnel, employees of the Jewish hospital where I had been working in order to temporarily escape any deportation. My job there was civil defense. On that particular night, I had worked there, and in the morning we were told that we all had to report, including nurses in uniform, in the center court of that hospital. We were standing in line, and then our names were mentioned. My name was mentioned. I saw there one of the two highest people in the Jewish Council by the name of Bram Asher. He was afterward excommunicated for cooperating with the Germans. And I asked him, would it do any good to rely upon, in quotes, Palestine papers? Through the Red Cross, I had requested that the telegram be sent to someone in Palestine, and on the basis of that, it was alleged by me that I might qualify to go to Palestine. And anyone who would have a paper like this from the Red Cross that might perhaps postpone any deportation. I asked him, would it help me any? He said, when you get to Westerbork, they'll take care of that. I was picked up with the others in a truck, and instead of going straight to the prison, the Dutch theater, we were given a tour of the city. They went all around. And I was wondering, why in the world would they do that? We are not tourists. Because it was a very short distance. Anyway, we were unloaded there. And when we were there, here came the point when I asked someone whom I knew as an acquaintance who was working for the Jewish Council, and he's the one who led me to this, to a row of jams, of toilets. I took either the one before the last. I probably didn't want to be in the last because it might be too obvious that I had done this on purpose. And I waited there, and I waited. I acted in a very natural physical way there. If anyone would catch me, I could say that I wasn't just standing or just sitting there. And I remember after a long, long time, I heard noise of people who were probably taken out onto the trains that went to Westerbork, and then suddenly it became quiet. And maybe half an hour or so later, this was around 1 o'clock, roughly, and they left maybe it got quiet around 12:30 or so. And I heard someone with, I recall that, not shoes, but heels, with heels.
With boots,
coming and opening and closing the doors of the jams. Every time he came closer, until he came to mine, which I had locked. He found it locked and he shouted, "Aufmachen!" I opened it and he punched me in the, it was from the left, he punched me in my left jaw and he kicked me in my left knee. And I said in the best German that I could say, "I have diarrhea, I will join the others." He again kicked me and he left me, which was of course one of the innumerable times that I was fortunate. He could have killed me or whatever. He was probably one of the green police, the green polizei. I left the John, did not join the others, but at the end of the row of Johns there was a water faucet with a basin. And I remember, I washed my hands, being very orthodox, and said Asher Yotzer in prayer. And after that, I didn't know what to do. So I stood there, I had a coat, I had a hat, which I had as being orthodox. And I took my hat, and with the sleeve of my right, the right sleeve of my coat, I kept on slowly brushing, cleaning it, almost like a ritual. I didn't know what else to do. And I kept stay there for hours and hours and hours until about 7:30. Maybe at one time I went to look as far as I felt it was safe and I came right away back, because what I remember is that I spent there lots of hours. 8 o'clock was curfew. 7:30 at the end of the row of toilets, I saw someone whose face I recognized. He was a member of the Jewish Council. I motioned to him, he came over and I told him what had happened. I divulged everything to him. I asked, "Can you help me to get me with the others? Because I can continue like this. I will need food, and if they catch me here, they'll be bad. Even worse than if I join the others." So he said, "Okay, wait a little while. I'll come back and I'll see what I can do." So after maybe a short while, he came back and he motioned that I come with him. So I came with him. He went from there, which was probably on the, let's say, the right side, which would be from the front of the building on the left side. We were on the left side of the prison theater. And he walked with me and came across the entrance lobby. And I saw that there was, on the right side in that lobby, a table and someone was sitting. He guided me further. We went up the stairs. And while we were up the stairs and I felt it was safe to talk to him, I asked him, "That guy was sitting there, is he German or Jewish?" I don't believe that he even answered me. But he made a right turn on the second floor and motioned, and I could see that the other Jews were there. And it was his idea that I continue there and he would go back. I saw him go back. I went after him. He came back to the same spot where I had seen that man next to the table, which was the entrance lobby. I had my coat over my arm. I had a obviously visible David Star, and I had a hat on. I did for sure not have the special band that the members of the Jewish Council had, who could walk in and out of that prison. And I was about to start going towards the exit. Someone behind me, I must assume from the Jewish Council, shouted very loud twice, "Morocco, Morocco," is the Dutch pronunciation. On my left, I could see someone in green uniform with a revolver. I continued walking as if angels were guiding me. I walked very calmly to the exit. When I came to the street, I saw that on the left was a German command car with, let's say, at least 10 uniformed Germans was arriving and stopping there. I went calmly even to the right. There was there, very close to the end of that block. By the way, that was the street where we lived on the left side. I made a right turn, not going home, because I knew that was the first thing they would look for me if they would notice I had left. I went back to the Jewish hospital. After a short distance past that corner, I started running. I remember that when I was still inside, I could hear the electric streetcar making that turn. It was line number 7, and there was always a high-pitched sound there, and they always had to keep that lubricated. And I told myself, I remember that, that sound, that's the sound of life. Freedom and life is just, only bricks separated me from that. And this was one of the things that probably motivated me to do what I did. I ran from there, my adrenaline overpowered me, I couldn't walk anymore. And besides, it was getting very close to 8 o'clock, I entered the hospital. I had a sister of my brother-in-law there as a nurse. And I went to her in the nurse's dorm, and she let me sleep there all night. I was in the bed of one of the nurses. They told me, keep your head covered. There is going to be a bed check by the head nurses, but they won't see you if you have just your head covered. And by the way, that is mentioned in Lisha Rose's book, The Tulips Are Red. Only with a few